Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. The intention was to start a study on the civilizations of Atlantis and Lemuria, including information about the prior civilization, which was started by a king of wisdom by the name of Pelagon. And I also intended to talk also about the Giza intelligences. These are three topics we've talked about before, but I think there's a whole lot there left undiscovered and unexamined. But as luck has it, and as we continue our studies, we often go off into areas that are related, although at first we don't understand why they're related, and then it becomes clear as you continue down this particular path that you've been led down or impulse down. I'm back in the book called The Goblet of Truth, which is one of Billy's most recent writings. It's a very important writing. And I recommend if you're starting to read the Meyer material that you print the material out and give your eyes some needed respite from the strain caused by the computer. And you also find it very pleasurable. It puts you in a completely different frame of mind while you're studying. So anyway, I've gone back through The Goblet of Truth, which is hundreds and hundreds of pages. I haven't gone through all hundreds, but I've gone through like 15 that I'm particularly interested in. And it starts with that title paragraph that I quote so much, what the truth knows to say. And let me read a section that I don't often quote. It says, respect or venerability towards the entirety of nature and towards the creation and its laws and recommendations must determine the human being's thoughts and feelings and his or her deeds. Now it says respect or venerability towards the entirety of nature. So let's define some of these words so we understand what they mean. And we get an appreciation for what's written here. Venerability means commanding respect because of great age or impressive dignity. Another definition for venerability is impressive or interesting because of age, antique appearance. Venerability can also mean old and respected, valued and respected because of old age, long use, etc. So the first thing that this paragraph tells us is that we should, as human beings, have respect towards the great age and impressive dignity and impressive dignity of nature and creation. And then it goes on to say that human beings must live in harmony with creation, with nature, with earth and the universe, as well as with all varieties of present existence that spring forth from these. And then it continues, rivers, stones, plants, animals, lakes, seas, brooks, springs, the air and water, trees and bushes, and everything that crawls and flies. Here on the earth are life forms with a spirit form, with very many of them being connected by psychic swinging waves. Now, we've talked about the psychic swinging waves before. Remember, we have a block or factor the Meyer material calls the psyche. The psyche is our material consciousness. And the psyche controls the thoughts and the feelings associated to our material consciousness. We have a counterpart to the psyche. The counterpart in the human spirit is called the Gemut. And the Gemut supplies the psyche with these harmonious swinging waves. And these swinging waves are mentioned more than once in the Goblet of Truth. And I think they're an important key to understanding what is going on in the human spirit. Remember, The human spirit is no bigger than the point of a needle, and it resides in the midbrain. The midbrain is the area of your brain that connects the left and the right hemisphere. The midbrain has an area in it called the superior colliculus. That's where the human spirit is. And the midbrain also consists of the tectum, the inferior, and the superior colliculus. Now, the superior colliculus is associated with eye movement, alertness, with the regulation of our body temperature and various things of that nature. So the superior colliculus is an important area because that's where the human spirit resides. It's a bump on the lateral part of the midbrain. It's also called the mesencephalon, which is, it's a portion of the central nervous system, and it's associated with vision, hearing, motor control, your sleep-wake, arousal, temperature regulation, and again, the midbrain consists of the tectum, and it also has within it the inferior colliculus and the superior colliculus. Superior colliculus is the area where the human spirit resides. The spirit is sometimes referred to as the spirit form. It's indestructible. It's eternally living. It's a loving entity. It's the real you. It's always developing. It resides in the human brain, but exactly in the superior colliculus. In some non-mammal species, including fish and birds, the tectum is the largest component of the brain. In mammals and primates, because of our extremely large cerebral cortex, the tectum is much smaller in proportion. But it remains very important because it's the integrating center, again, for the eye movements. And in the 1970s and 1990s, they did studies on mammals, mostly monkeys, and they monitored the superior colliculus in controlling eye movements. And they also noticed that when the animals' heads were free to move, that there was a combining of the head and the eye movements. So the superior colliculus is involved in many multisensory integrations, which makes perfect sense if your human spirit is there. It probably is the place where we'll have telepathy, telekinesis, and things like that. And I'm kind of speculating there, but that seems pretty logical to me. Now, in the following passage, the words Weisenheiten is used. Weisenheiten, a quick definition, is an immaterial, material existence form without a self-determining possibility of evolution. Now, what's weird in this passage is the Weisenheiten are said to be communicating with one another. And I'll give you a couple examples of Weisenheiten in the German. Air is considered a Weisenheiten. Water is Weisenheiten. I typically don't think of those things as communicating. Now, the universal consciousness is also considered a Weisenheiten. And my understanding is the universal consciousness has no personality, but it radiates love. It doesn't personally love us, but like the sun radiates light, it radiates love. And anyway, let me continue to read this. Back to the Goblet of Truth. All of them are Weisenheiten that communicate with one another, all knowing about their common existence among one another. The consciousness and psyche of all created creations are in turn bound on a journey through time, incorporating very many bodily existences through the innumerable forms in which life appears. In this process, death is a passage to rebirth as well as the conversion into the other world, the world of pure spirit. This is the basis for the tightly woven and indissoluble web of all life, and in this wise, no life form strives to rise up above others within their group and set themselves up over the others. Because each life form contains a basic goodness and not evil. After all, evil is learned and practiced as a result of inappropriate doings in Asartang. Now, the passage I just read mentioned the Weisenheiten, and it also mentioned something called the tightly woven web of all life. Woven means to interlace. Threads, yarn, strips, fibrous material form a fabric or material. To interlace means to cross one another, typically passing alternately over and under, as if woven together, to intertwine. And it also referred to the word indissoluble here when it was talking about that web of life. And the word indissoluble has meanings like firm and stable, and mean incapable of being dissolved. And I'm at the end of that little section, we talked about this German word Asartung. Asartung is a noun, and it means to get very badly out of control of the good human nature. Let me continue to read here in the Goblet of Truth. Irrespective of what is involved, whether simple or fanatical religions and sects, stubborn nationalism, fascism, might-greedy politics, terrorism, or neocapitalism, etc., all of these directions are aberrations of the negative and evil, and represent an immense threat to all the peoples of the earth, in particular in the third millennium. Well, what is the third millennium? Remember when Billy had his contacts with Thoth? As a young boy growing up in Bulak, Switzerland, in an area called Niederflux, where he was called into the Horgen forest, and out of the sky came this silvery pear-shaped craft, and Thoth stepped out and started eventually telling Billy about this third millennium, which is the age that we're currently in. And Thoth stated that the third millennium began when the United States dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in the third millennium, we're supposed to have a kind of maliciousness and confusion will spread over the earth, and there will be a slowly approaching global collapse. And in the third millennium, it says our leaders will become megalomaniacal, and they will take away our rights of self-determination, and the people will become indolent, lazy, obtuse, slow to understand, and indifferent. And this will be a breeding ground for certain negative historical trends, one of which will be anger and conflict. But the previous passage talked about fascism. Now, fascism can be defined as a governmental system which is led by a dictator having complete power, forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism. Does this sound like where the United States is headed? It does to me. It goes on to say here that fascism, I don't know why I can't say that this evening, fascism regiments all of industry, commerce. It emphasizes an aggressive nationalism and even racism at times. The other term that's mentioned in that passage is neo-capitalism, which is an economic ideology which blends capitalism with other systems. Like, neo-capitalism is said to have an extensive welfare system. And neo-capitalism is different than the capitalism that existed before World War II. Now, in the previous passage, when it was talking about the fanatical religions, the sects, stubborn nationalism, fascism, might greedy politics, terrorism, or neocapitalism, it described these directions as aberrations. What is an aberration? An aberration is the act of departing from the right, normal, or usual course. So I suppose our religions, fascism, neocapitalism, are departing from what is right and from the normal course. And truly, the danger of catastrophe befalling humanity has never been so great as today and in the future. Cynical materialism and unbridled neocapitalism, which have now overtaken the entire world, are already leading to extremely serious damage to nature and the morality of human beings on Earth. And this damage continues to grow in relationship to the irresponsible increase in overpopulation. One of the biggest problems that is not understood is the problem of overpopulation. Now, you'll hear people say you can fit all of the people in the world into Texas. Well, that's true. But they don't give you the picture of what it would be like to have all the people in the world in Texas. First of all, Texas has 262,000 square miles, which is a lot of space. Texas is a big place. If you divide it by 7 billion, you'll get a 10 meter by 10 meter square. So everyone will now have a 10 meter by a 10 meter square to live in. Well, there's another problem. 50% of Texas is desert. So you don't really have a 10 meter by 10 meter square to live in, because a lot of these folks won't be able to live in a desert. And then you have to ask yourself, well, these 7 billion people that we've crammed into Texas, what kind of standard of living are they going to have? Are they going to have a standard of living like the rest of the people in the United States? Are they going to have a car? Are they going to have a house? Well, if they are, well, you're going to have to build roads. You're going to have to build factories to build the cars and help build things in the houses. You're going to have shopping malls and grocery stores. And then you're going to realize that a lot of people won't be able to grow anything. So they won't be able to be self-sustaining. So now you're going to have farms and agriculture. And before you know it, you've got cities and you've got the horrible mess that we have in many areas of today. Bangladesh is one of the examples I often use of the destruction that's going on in the world today. Bangladesh, a little country the size of Ohio, with a population of about 167 million to 157 million, somewhere between those two numbers, which is a number so large it produces cognitive dissonance. It's something we can't even imagine. In Ohio here, we have 11.5 million people. Let's listen to this clip on Bangladesh's population, its slum dwellers, and its struggle for clean water access. Now, how does this, just before I play this clip, how does this all fit into Atlantis and Lemuria? We've had two civilizations that destroyed themselves before us. We had civilization of Pelagon, civilization of Atlantis and Lemuria. We're headed down the path of self-destruction. So let's not go there. Let's learn these lessons that were taught in the Goblet of Truth and some of the things we're going to hear on these clips.
Next, today is World Water Day. Tonight, we look at an innovative approach to getting clean water to slum dwellers in so-called megacities. Our story is another in our occasional reports about population issues around the globe. It's part of a collaboration with National Geographic Magazine and the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting and comes from special correspondent Steve Sapienza in Bangladesh.
Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, is one of the world's fastest growing cities and one of the poorest. As in many other developing countries, people are leaving the countryside in search of work and a better life in the city. Dhaka's population, now estimated at 15 million, is expected to hit 20 million by 2025.
Dhaka is one of the megacities which is growing too fast.
Country director for the charity WaterAid, Dr. Khairul Islam, says the increased population density is severely taxing the city's ability to house and care for its people.
Almost 5,000 slums are in and around Dhaka city, and almost one-third of the population are living in either low-income communities and slum areas. Most of them don't have ownership over those pieces of land that they're residing. But the main challenge is provisioning essential services for this huge number of population, mainly water and sanitation.
With 2,000 newcomers daily, the struggle to find clean water in the slums often has life-threatening consequences.
Water? Yes, we have water, but the water is not always available. When water is available, it is often bad. Yesterday, a woman here thought she had cholera. She went to the hospital, but she died last night.
If you want to see the human toll exacted by unsafe water and poor sanitation in Dhaka, you come here. This is the overflow tent at the short stay unit at Dhaka's main cholera and diarrhea hospital.
This man arrived at the hospital with no vital signs. After 15 minutes of trying to revive him, his wife is given the news. The staff records cholera as the cause of death. The hospital's lead research scientist, Dr. S.K. Roy, and his colleagues work around the clock 365 days a year to save lives threatened by waterborne illness. The majority of the patients here are the urban poor, and the hospital care is free.
We are now having about 400 patients every day. But in August, September, sometime we go up to 1,200 a day. And I can tell you the average of a year is 120,000 patient average of a year. So this hospital is a quite busy one. Most of them having E. coli diarrhea, cholera diarrhea. Then we are having a typhoid patient, quite high number. So these are coming through water and hand behavior, hand contamination.
Most diarrhea patients.
They're talking about the problem of cholera, diarrhea, because of the impure water in Bangladesh. And the Goblet of Truth here warns us of things like this. It's a cynical materialism and unbridled neocapitalism, which have now overtaken the entire world, are already leading to extremely serious damage to nature and to the morality of human beings on Earth. And this damage continues to grow in relation to the irresistible increase in overpopulation. Things have already reached the state that when a clash of industrial nations could occur, something which can scarcely be stopped any longer, and will also cast the nations of the third world, a third world nation like Bangladesh, into the same darkness. And if this happens, a third global conflagration will be imminent. A global conflagration like a collapse of nature, like the third world war. These various possibilities are a potential. Back in 1967, we could have had a Third World War during the Arab-Israeli War. Let's listen to this little clip that talks about just that war.
June 5th, 1967. 7:45 a.m. Israel delivers a stunning opening blow in the Six-Day War. Within a few hours, the Israeli airstrike has devastated the Egyptian Air Force. Fighting on three different fronts against the combined might of three Arab armies, Israel would win a war in the space of just 6 days. How did this tiny nation achieve one of the most astonishing victories in the history of warfare? Eyewitness testimony, unique access to secret military plans, and weapons testing reveal the extraordinary story of how Israel won the 6 day war. In early June 1967, tensions in the Middle East were rising. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser had called on the Arab nations to destroy Israel. War seemed inevitable. Israel faced the grim prospect of a simultaneous invasion from Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. The combined Arab armies had a massive superiority in numbers of soldiers, tanks, and fighter aircraft.
Israel is viewed not only by themselves, but by the rest of the world as a scrappy little nation on the very edge of survival.
The general mood in the Arab world was that Israel is not that strong. It could be defeated.
Yet against most expectations, the opposite happened. In less than a week, Israel had defeated its Arab neighbors. How was such a stunning victory achieved? To understand the reasons for Israel's victory, it's necessary to go back to the early 1960s. At that time, Yoash Sidan was chief of planning in the IAF, the Israeli Air Force.
It was pretty obvious that not later than 68, they will eventually attack.
A military coalition between Egypt and Syria meant Israel would be facing battles on at least two fronts. It could expect attacks from Egypt through the Sinai Desert and by Syria from the Golan Heights. And it seemed possible that both Jordan and Iraq would add their weight to the Arab force.
Now, the question was, can you defend this kind of a sliver of the Mediterranean if they attack? The answer is no.
The best form of defense would be a strong offense, a preemptive strike. But such a strategy created its own problems.
The Israelis could not afford to put all of their oomph against the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Syrians at the same time. They had to concentrate. The Israelis had to concentrate their force against one enemy at a time.
To fight a war the way it wanted, Israel would need to gain air superiority. Once the Arab air forces had been dealt with, Israel could fight each of their ground forces in turn. In 1964, Sidan's team came up with an unorthodox plan.
The idea that we came to was to strike their airstrips.
These classified plans have remained secret for 40 years. They reveal how Israel would achieve air superiority. The primary objective would be to keep the Arab air forces on the ground.
By disabling the runways of the Egyptian Air Force, and then the Syrian, etc., etc., you prevent the aircraft from taking off.
Targeting the runways would take hundreds of Arab aircraft out of the equation. The plan was good, in theory. But what were its chances of success?
Well, that's just a modern example of this historical trend that can be traced all the way back to 150,000 years ago. 150,000 years ago, King of Wisdom and Ishwish, a man at the fifth stage of human evolution, named Pelagon, elected himself the leader of a group of about 70,000 human beings, and they took some great spacerships. I believe they were actually in the Pleiaren star system, and they made a wild escape here to the Earth. And on board these stolen spaceships, they had 200 very good scientists in very different fields of knowledge. And Pelagon was elected as their leader, and they used the word Ishwish, or King of Wisdom. And he was a very benevolent Ishwish. He was actually respected by the native earth humans at that time, who were dark-skinned, and they would sometimes see him allegedly floating above the ground with the power of his own mind, and he was said to be able to cause plants to grow with the ability of his own mind. He lived for about 2,000 years, and the people of the earth were very prosperous during that time. And this was, remember, an extraterrestrial human civilization. They built up very large cities, and the flourishing time, I understand, lasted almost 10,000 years. At least if you read this current translation of Contact 59. Now, exactly how accurate some of these numbers are is a good question. Pelagon died, and someone took over for him, and who was not so benevolent as a leader as Pelagon was. And I believe that the King of Wisdom's name was Jessus, and a great war broke out, one of the worst wars in the history of the earth. Remember, these were extraterrestrial humans who came to the earth in the ancient past. And it says here, there happened an earthly world war of measure like never before, nor in later time until today was brought upon the earth. So this history of repeating wars is something that we don't want to have happen here on earth. And we're in the third millennium, and a very negative historical trend has taken place. I want to play some of the sounds of the Ukraine war that recently took place, just to remind you of how real and horrible war it really is. From the Goblet of Truth. And again, the Goblet of Truth is talking about a potential global war. And if this happens, a third global conflagration will be imminent in whatever form it takes. Indeed, the human beings of Earth are well on their way to this. Therefore, it is only a question of time and rationality as and when and whether it will actually occur. However, it is once again the case that the signs are pointing to the whole thing being unavoidable. However, this third world conflagration may take various forms, such as a collapse of nature, which has been desecrated and flouted by the human beings of Earth, as have the atmosphere, the water, the planet as a whole, and the animal kingdom. To put it simply, a global catastrophe, and the collapse would result in the collapse of civilization, leading into the final analysis to the total extermination of the human beings on Earth, or at least a regression to the harshest forms of primitive living. So, the civilization in the ancient past of Pelagon, remember these were extraterrestrial humans who came to the Earth, very advanced human beings. They had a very flourishing civilization, but it fell and destroyed itself in warfare. So let's not make that mistake. Let's not be like Atlantis and Lemuria, the next civilization that eventually destroyed itself in warfare. Here's a clip of some U.S. soldiers speaking out about the negativity that's going and taking place right now in the United States.
This is the United States of America! Why are you hurting people? If you want to go kill and hurt people, go to Iraq.
Why y'all doing this to people? Right. Y'all walk around in riot gear like this is a war.
I saw them beating people that had nothing to do with anything, just grabbing people out of the crowd. There's no honor in that. My mom, my father, everybody has served in Iraq, Afghanistan. Well, I did 14 months in Iraq. My father was in Afghanistan. My mother did a year in Iraq. We fought for this country. I don't come home. I'm in New York City. I am from New York City. And these cops are hurting people that I fought to protect. There's no reason for this. There's no honor in unarmed civilians. And I won't let it happen. Have a good night.
Yeah!
I served with Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines, as an automatic machine gunner. There's a term, once a Marine, always a Marine, but there's also the term, eat the apple, F the Corps. I don't work for you no more.
What sort of training did you have as a Marine? I mean, were you given cultural awareness?
This Republican-Democrat thing, all the world is a stage. Obama is a puppet. He reads the script. He's a teleprompter reader. That's his official job. He doesn't make any decisions. The powers that be that have the majority of power in this world are those that control the financial system. The financial crisis engineered by these same criminals who are the ultimate fraudsters of the world. The Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, those are the real string pullers. That's real power. War is out of control, and those who are destroying this world by the fraud and deception is what's out of control. 9/11 was the false flag operation used to justify the invasion of Afghanistan. It is the ultimate deception, and it's done for a full-spectrum dominance agenda, which is part of controlling this world by deception. And unless we as people stand up to these treasonous traitors and all of those people carrying out this stuff and the colluders, including the mass media and the politicians, we are going to continue to get this kind of deception.
The individual is handicapped by...
Let me read again. This is from Contact 251. It said World War III cannot be averted if man fails to finally become reasonable. The war will begin with conventional weaponry and escalate to nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare. The world war will begin in November of a specific year. Ironic, here we are in November.
Fight in the war. I joined up, month out of training, I arrived in Baghdad, Iraq. We believed 9/11 was a lie. This is in 04. Every sort of service believed 9/11 was a lie. We thought the people would expose the lie, know the war's a lie, and bring us home.
I'm outraged at what is going on. Again, they're using this idea of patriotism and honor. That's bullshit. This war is not about honor. This war is about profiteering. This war is about money. We're nothing but pawns being used for their political agendas. We need to wake up. And these politicians need to stop playing with the citizens' emotions and trying to get them this emotional high and patriotism. Let's speak reality. We need to wake up America.
What you see...
Falling back into total primitive anarchy is also possible, meaning that all the life forms still existing would only be capable of a vegetative existence full of suffering. Viewing the whole thing from this threatening perspective means no more and no less than the human beings of Earth will sacrifice all their valuable achievements through a global catastrophe. And all because they had followed a flawed development for millennia in terms of true love, freedom, harmony, and real peace among all life forms.
Served my country. I got an honorable discharge from the Army. And I swore an oath to protect the country from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, these people that are operating in our government right now are criminals. Whatever you hear on TV isn't what the reality is. you are losing your rights as we speak. At H.R. 2749, which is the Food Safety Act, and this affects the entire country, they can stop all forms of transportation in and out of the state. They can destroy vehicles. They can declare martial law, and they can shut restaurants down. They can shut down supermarkets. And that's why they put all these hot button issues out there to distract people, so they argue amongst themselves, like race and abortion and terrorism and health care and God only knows what else. They got you all distracted arguing amongst each other while they're all fucking robbing us. And people don't know. I talk to people today.
Indeed, in the present day, it is possible to see an apocalypse of this kind looming threateningly on the horizon and over the destiny of the human beings of the earth. Because even long ago, the blossoming culture of the truth was destroyed globally, and evil Gewalt and every kind of Asartung set in its place a thing that has happened in particular due to the machinations of politicians, false lives, false penal codes, as well as religions and sects.
The true meaning of liberty is driven by economic myths. Who would have ever thought that the current generation and Congress would stand idly by and watch such a rapid disintegration of the American Republic, which is equivalent to granting dictatorial powers to the president? Our presidents can now, on their own, order assassinations, including American citizens, enforce indefinite imprisonments without due process, treat all Americans as suspected terrorists, it appears, that the fate of the American Republic is now sealed.
Every time our country stands in the path of danger, an instinct seems to summon her finest first. It's always the patriots who first hear the call. When loss of liberty is looming, as it is now, the siren sounds first. When ordinary hands can possess such an extraordinary instrument, that symbolizes the full measure of human dignity and liberty. That's why those five words issue an irresistible call to us all. So, as we set out this year to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed. From my cold, dead hands.
This is the United States of America.
I wanted to bring out a point that was stated in that clip, that presidents can now order assassinations. And one of the leaders in the peace movement that was assassinated back, oh, I think in the 1980s, if I remember correctly, was a man named John Lennon. John Lennon, who said, imagine a world where we live as one. This is ESPN looking back at the John Lennon assassination, and you'll hear Howard Cosell.
Close your eyes. Imagine no cell phones, no Twitter, no 24-hour sports and news cycles. Communication outside the home was the nearest payphone on a street corner. Hard to imagine today unless you lived it. That was the case 30 years ago to date, December 8th, 1980, the day John Lennon was shot and killed. But for millions of people, the news didn't come across from their local news anchor or Walter Cronkite. It came from the most familiar voice in all of sports to this day, Howard Cosell on Monday Night Football. Tom Rinaldi shares the backstory of that historically tragic night.
The death of a man who sang and played the guitar overshadows the news.
By the time Walter Cronkite began the nightly news on December 9th, 1980, the biggest single news story in the world was more than 18 hours old. In America, millions of people didn't find out what happened from a newscast or a special report. They learned John Lennon was dead by watching a football game.
Hello again, everyone, and we're excited about tonight because
The Patriots have not been able to beat Shula and Miami here at the Orange Bowl since 1966.
That night in New York City, a local TV news producer for WABC, Alan Weiss, was in a motorcycle accident in Central Park and taken to nearby Roosevelt Hospital.
One of the EMTs said to me, "You're really lucky. If it was the weekend with all the shootings and stuff that go on, you could be in the ER for hours before anybody sees you, but it's a quiet night tonight."
A 24-yard attempt.
The Dolphins tied the game at the end of the third quarter. Cosell, Gifford, and Fran Tarkenton called the action.
Frank, you just can't come into a game the way New England has come into this. Fighting for a playoff berth, you've got to go all out and be aggressive.
In New York, Weiss noticed another patient being wheeled past him.
Two of the police officers come out, and I hear one officer say to the other one, "Can you believe it? John Lennon." I opened up my eyes and I looked up and I said, "Excuse me, officer, what did you say?"
Just before 11 that night, outside the Dakota, his apartment building.
Now, if you listen to the rest of that clip, you'll find out the man that killed John Lennon was kind of a weird religious fanatic who was getting what he thought were messages from God or something to that effect. And the Goblet of Truth states here, in the Christian world, the blame for all of these negative historical trends that we've been talking about lies fairly and squarely at the door of the Roman Catholic Church. Christianity as a monotheistic and strictly autocratically oriented religion is guilty of developing completely new evil and Asclepiotic directions of thought and forms of state after the fall of the despotic Roman Empire, which spread all over earth and under which all human beings are suffering in the new time. It was in particular the Roman Catholic Church that inherited the practices of the inhuman Roman Imperium, establishing an evil consciousness conditioning tyranny in the place of the former Roman military tyranny, which reached its accumulation in the Inquisition, but has continued uninterrupted even in a reduced form. So the Meyer material often talks about how our religions have confused the idea of a universal consciousness with the idea of God. And they say that our anthropomorphic idea of God is not correct. And our religions, particularly the Roman Catholic religion, has led to certain aberrations like the sexual abuse of children.
Tonight's program contains descriptions of child sexual abuse. Viewer discretion is advised.
Funding for Frontline is provided by the Park Foundation, committed to raising public awareness, with additional funding for this program from the Jerome Foundation in celebration of the Jerome Hill Centennial. Frontline is made possible by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Tonight on Frontline.
All those years when I lived in silence, I believed that I was the only one.
In recent decades, more than 10,000 children were reportedly sexually abused by Catholic priests. But years before the headlines, one family broke the story for themselves.
For the 12 years since my brother told me, I've been wondering how he could have hit it so well, and where.
Tonight, filmmaker Joe Cotrera and his brother Paul tell a very personal story.
This was my first sexual experience.
The story of a secret held for 30 years.
I remember him saying, "You don't tell anybody about this. This is part of your penance."
for the abuse of power.
The church moved him around from parish to parish. When this guy was accused of molesting kids.
And the triumph over betrayal.
The game's over. You guys are not the ones who can preach to us.
Tonight on Frontline, one family's encounter with the hand of God.
They're all taped. Take a look at these tapes. The title, see if you can remember.
It says Paul.
What's this one? Let's see if I can remember this.
I remember places where it happened. I remember smells. I remember the sun coming through the rectory window. I remember the placement of the furniture in the room in the rectory. I remember the red leather upholstery. I, for the life of me, cannot remember how long it happened. My guess is it happened over the course of about 4 to 6 months between the spring and the summer in 64. There's parts that you just, you know, I think your subconscious protects you. It just kicks in and you don't want to remember that. It's not the story of my life. It is a thing that happened to me. It's got to be confusing to people. People must wonder, how could you let this happen to you? Why didn't you tell somebody about it? Why didn't you stop it? Why didn't you walk out of the room? I think that it's hard enough for me to understand how I let it happen to me. I mean, it's hard, you know, that's part of what sort of beat myself up for years, and you know, I thought I'd let it happen to me. It's that whole power structure, that whole environment that we're in that allows this to happen, and hopefully something like this can explain that.
This is my brother Paul, my father Paul, my grandfather Paul. My name's Joe.
You know, I don't like to be in films.
This is my mother, Josephine.
Oh, God.
Her father, Joseph. This is Nonna, my grandmother, Maria. My sister, Maria. Mary, mother of God. Here's how it all starts. Salem, Massachusetts, best known for its witchcraft trials and executions. Our small pocket of the city was an Italian neighborhood, close-knit, one house tied to the next, by clotheslines, by culture, by bonds of family and friendship. And in that neighborhood, a church, St. Mary's Italian, built in 1925 by the neighbors, a place where everyone met for religion and community, a tribute to lost loved ones. Down the street was our house, built by my grandfather Joseph, my mother's father. It's where we grew up and where my parents still live.
54, you weren't even born then.
This is Paul and Maria.
My sister Maria was 10 years older than me, and my brother Paul, 9. You lived in this house, and you came to know it intimately. On every spare wall, Jesus, Mother Mary, and the saints, keeping time, tracking our movements. In the hallway, popes and cardinals kept an eye on the door and the stairs. We lived up those stairs, where the saints made room on the walls for my father's paintings. It was a hobby he came home to after days of factory labor. In this house, there was comfort in details, familiar crevices and paint peels, family hiding places. For 30 years, my brother Paul hid a secret about something that happened to him in Salem, not far from here.
Wait a hell of
and for the 12 years since he told me, I've been wondering how he could have hit it so well, and where. And so I've been looking back at those hiding spots we both knew, and looking for other spots that Paul just kept to himself.
It was a big Italian family. Our grandmother and a couple of our aunts and uncles lived downstairs. From time to time, there were various cousins and our older Sicilian relatives who were sharing the space.
Nonna, she would talk to us in Italian, and she was a love. It was a wonderful, you know, childhood.
Mom had seven brothers and sisters. You know, I'd say for the first 10 years of my life, they all lived in that same house or within a block of each other. You're surrounded by family. It was very protective, very safe, very nurturing. There were all these people who clearly loved you, and you were very much like them. Maybe the downside of it was that once you got out into a world where people weren't speaking that dialect and people weren't your family, you know, you could get into some trouble.
When we first got married, my wife and I agreed that all my children had to have a Catholic education.
The Italian church, St. Mary's, didn't have a school. And St. James, which was the Irish parish not that far away, they had a kindergarten through high school. I still dream that I'm in that school building. I was all nuns. There were no lay teachers back in those days.
That dress is frightful enough in itself. If you came home and you said, oh, sister, somebody was yelling at me, it wasn't, what's wrong with sister? What's wrong with you? What did you do? As children, we were very passive, and we were just told to do it. We did it.
The May processions, well, every year they would have this procession. They'd get every kid from kindergarten all the way up to the graduating girls in the senior class. A long line of kids. Each of their nuns would be standing next to them with a little clicker, keeping them in line. Some girl in the senior class, they'd pick the May Queen. They had these little page boys with a little blue beret-like puffy hat and a kind of little skirt-like thing. If you could get a kid to dress up like that, you could get a kid to do anything. There was the Catholic Church, and everything else was hell. Everyone beyond the bounds of the Catholic Church were doomed. Everything was presented to you in terms of sin. I remember these images of hell. Souls being tossed down into hell and the flames coming up and the devil being down there. The vision you had of life that you picked up early on was that you had to sort of tread a narrow path. There were a lot of things that you just shouldn't do, and if you did them and had the misfortune of dying soon thereafter, you were going to be one of those souls that were being tossed down into the flames. So it was sort of this game that you played where you committed these sins and then you'd go into the confessional on Saturday and reel off your sins and the priest would say, yep, okay, you're safe, go. And then you'd go out and do it again and then you'd come back and say it again. I bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Well, that's the story of sexual abuse among Catholic priests, and Meyer material warns us about the Roman Catholic Church and what has happened and what it's done to our psyche and how it's damaged us. Well, folks, we probably started the beginning of a long journey here. I'm going through the Goblet of Truth and also comparing that against some of the things that have happened in our ancient past in the civilizations of Atlantis and Lemuria, and the civilization that preceded that, which was the civilization of Pelagon. Hope you've enjoyed this evening's show. I've enjoyed bringing it to you. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We'll be back before long. Have a good evening.